The song is called For Charles Bronson.
Who are you?
My name's Charles Bronson.
Charles Bronson.
Charles Bronson.
Got a face like Charles Bronson.
Charles Bronson.
I'm Charles Bronson, the vigilante.
Charles Bronson is back.
The pissed off kids waiting for Death Wish 6 like Bronson.
Charles Bronson.
But you've never seen Bronson like this. Like this. Or like this.
You gotta give him a big rest in peace, though, right?
Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of the Bad Idea Podcast. We're your co-hosts, Simon Abrams.
And Steve Carlson.
And today's episode, or this month's episode, is dedicated to the craptacular J. Lee Thompson and Charles Bronson collaborations. We should probably explain the podcast for those of you who are listening to us for the first time. The podcast is basically dedicated to any group of any idea that comes into our head that is not necessarily sound. It's basically it has evolved into a sort of sadistic torture between my co-host and I, where he programs a movie and tries to hurt me with it, and I program a movie and I try to hurt him with it. And it's, you know, these movies aren't necessarily bad films. It's just that if you group them together and you watch them together, it is a bad idea for cinephiles or just anyone who just enjoys having a good time. So it's sort of like an adventurous form of dumpster diving.
Basically, yeah.
And for this episode, we tied into a bit of research that I've been doing for a test chapter that I'm writing and currently rewriting, that's about action, movie violence and explicit gore in the action cinema of the 80s. And the topic, because I wrote also about Stallone and Schwarzenegger, but I chose Bronson because his movies are worse than those guys. Bronson is interesting at this point in his career. You know, he is a star, and in a much smaller scale than a Stallone or a Schwarzenegger. He's a figure that is a bit, you know, because the history of Bronson pictures at the time are largely dependent on first-hand accounts from interviews that guys like Paul Talbot, who wrote Bronson's Loose and Bronson's Loose Again, are heavily relying on these interviews with people who knew Bronson. And they're very respectful interviews, they're very in-depth, they're full of rich details, but they're also full of contradictory characterizations of the man. They would often tell you that Bronson was very enamored with giving fans what they wanted, he liked being famous, in other words, and he liked to pander to people's expectations, but that also made him upset. I mean, there were a lot of heavy rewrites in the movies of the 80s that he was in. There was a lot of, there was just a general air of discontent, which shows in the way that he presents himself in the media. And, you know, he wasn't always he was consistently reluctant to do interviews. He didn't like being interviewed at all. At one point in Roger Ebert's profile of him circa the first Death Wish, he talks about wanting to strangle Jay Cox for what he wrote about him in Time, so, you know, he held grudges. He was not the cuddliest subject, but, you know, at the same time, there was some stuff going on at the time in the 80s. His wife was battling Jill Ireland, who was his co-star frequently in a lot of movies, going as far back and even earlier than Hard Times, but Jill Ireland was struggling with breast cancer. And she would even write in 1987 a memoir called Life Wish. Mm. But basically, there's that going on in the background, but there was also a constant demand from Bronson to do rewrites on pictures of the period. And rather than just talk theoretically about the movies that we're going to discuss, I think we're going to start with because he collaborated with the filmmaker J. Lee Thompson, who is a little older than Bronson. Bronson was in his 60s at the time. J. Lee Thompson was in his 70s. And Thompson had a reputation for being a bit of being not just over the hill. Like in the 70s and 80s, or not in the 70s and 80s, 60s and 70s, he had a reputation as being a drunk and a substance abuser. And this was basically his not quite comeback period, but something like that. And he only really started to make profitable movies when he teamed up with Bronson, starting with Cabo Blanco, I believe, was their first of 9 collaborations.
Is that
before The White Buffalo? Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
That was before The White Buffalo. And they went on to, as I said, do 9 collaborations. Their last one being the film that we're going to discuss last, Kinchite Forbidden Subject.
Ooh, boy.
And these movies got progressively sleazier. Although, I would say maybe not progressively, but they were...
I was going to say, there's definitely a line in a slope in how sleazy they get, but at the same time, there's also that one crater right in the middle with Messenger of Death.
Messenger of Death
is a weird one,
and we'll get to it, but as usual, tortured production history led to some interesting results. But which is the one we're starting with?
I think we're going to go chronologically, which means we're starting with 10 to Midnight.
When there is no justice, this man is the law. 10 to Midnight.
10 to Midnight, yes. 10 to Midnight is plenty sleazy. It's one of several indicators of the Clint Eastwood influence on Bronson, because it's very much about a hothead cop who doesn't play by the rules, and he doesn't understand the point of Miranda rights and, you know, defenses like, you know, making lenient judgments on accused killers who are mentally insane.
Yeah, there's at least 3 different lines of dialogue where Bronson is like, you know, there's legal and then there's, you know, what's moral. And the whole film has this dichotomy between the law and the good. And
yeah.
It's kind of telling that, among other things, that the only way Bronson can actually get justice done is to get fired from the force.
Right.
So... It's an interesting little film, but I mean, we should probably go down at least what it's about first. 10 to Midnight is about Charles Bronson playing a cop who plays by his own rules, and he's on the trail of a serial killer who has been killing women, and you know, setting up airtight alibis for while he does so. And then Bronson plants some evidence and tries to get the guy arrested the legal way. And he plants like the one shred of evidence that this guy knows without a doubt he could never have left, because he puts some blood on his clothing. And this guy commits all his murders in the nude for that exact reason. It's a very strange film. And
yes. I mean, so, the title has nothing to do with anything.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the title has to do with anything, but...
Well, the title was basically chosen because producers Menahem Golan and Yoram Globus really just had that... They liked that title, and they had it in their back pocket, and they were just like, why don't we just announce that the next Bronson movie without a script is going to be called 10 to Midnight? And they're like, okay. It didn't have anything to do with the plot. They just really liked that title.
They're just like, we're naming a movie this, damn it.
Yep. And this was not the first... of the Bronson films to be produced by the Globus and Golan group.
Of the 4 films we're covering today, 3 of them are canon/Golan-Globus films.
I think their first collaboration was Death Wish 2, actually, because even though it was not a canon film, it was produced by them because canon, being canon, announced that they, in the trades, they made a slate of potential titles of upcoming films. It wasn't potential titles, because they were saying these movies are coming out next. And amongst them was Death Wish 2. And Death Wish 2,
have the rights for it at all.
Dino De Laurentiis did. So Dino De Laurentiis is according to the screenwriter, the author of the book that Death Wish is based on, according to them, Golan and Globus was essentially muscled into making Death Wish 2. Their claim was that De Laurentiis was like, listen, I can sue your ass off and get the money because you're libelously claiming that you have rights to this picture, or you give me a cut of my determination and make the picture. So rather than getting sued and make no movie and no money,
they went
they chose to make a little money.
And they did that by essentially remaking the first Death Wish, but that's neither here nor there.
Yeah. But yeah, so there's a history, in other words,
yeah,
of collaborating with Golan Globus, who many of you, as many of you will know, were not, they were exploitation filmmakers that happened to run a studio. I mean, these guys worked with guys like Stallone and Schwarzenegger and things like that. But
Jean Cassavetes and Jean-Luc Godard.
Yes. But at the same time, it was, you know, they were schlockmeisters. They've had a exploitation mentality. And 10 to Midnight shows that, because even though you can see there's an integrity to the Dirty Harry films, or at least the first one.
Yeah, there's definitely a certain ambiguity about whether or not Harry's actually doing the right thing.
Yeah, they question the integrity of the character, whereas 10 to Midnight is always, it's actually pretty fascinated with the psychopathic character played by, what's his name?
Gene Davis.
Gene Davis, yeah. And that, I think, is telling, because they're, as in Kinjite, there's like this weird have-it-both-ways mentality where the characters are really just fixated on the crime that needs to be punished rather than the people doing the punishing and the toll that it takes, yeah, on a character like Bronson.
Well, I think it's more specifically, it's you know, because the Dirty Harry films are obviously the model here, but the Dirty Harry character is, you know, maybe not the character, but the at least the original film is fairly conflicted about Harry's role in the system, and, you know, his ability to do his job correctly. There's that incredible shot where right as he catches the Scorpio Killer, that just spirals out of the football stadium, like, you know, like the camera itself can't bear to look at this.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that sort of that tension there, and 10 to Midnight doesn't have any of that at all.
It's like this
world would be so much better if cops could just shoot people for no reason.
And it's not even fixated on that. It's like, it's more fixated on, like, rubbing your face in the nastiness of this character. I mean, he makes obscene phone calls. He runs around and kills Patrick Bateman style, and completely in the buff.
Yep.
He, you know, he preys on women specifically.
Does it with a switchblade, which of course, you know, it's, you know. And just as I'm thinking, oh, yeah, of course, switchblade, phallus, you know, the knife is his penis. And then we literally get a line of dialogue where Charles Bronson says, anybody does something like this, that knife is their penis.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, there's definitely a through line in that sense between this film and the movie we're going to talk about last, Kinjite.
Yeah.
But I think there's a competence to 10 to Midnight that makes it a little more harder to dismiss. Like, if I would
I mean, if of the four films we've seen, we're talking about today, 10 to Midnight is definitely the most professional, the slickest, the most atmospheric.
Mm-hmm.
It's overall, it's the best directed of the films we're going to talk about today, and it could very well be because you know, Thompson was still relatively in control of his powers at that point. As I understand it, he got sick on Messenger of Death, had to be had to have someone else finish the film for him. And then Kinjite was his last film. And I guess I would imagine it's safe to assume that he was probably not doing so well during the production of that.
Yeah, that's true. But, I mean, he was well enough to do interviews, and it was funny. There's a great line. We'll get to that later.
Yeah.
But basically, you're right about that. And, you know, it's just funny because, like, the stories about these movies, there's a hint of defensiveness about, like, you know, we have to defend the character of these people that we worked with because we're so grateful. And that's the tone that I get from a lot of these things. A lot of the guys that were working on this film, it was either their first roles or they're almost their last. I mean, there was very little in between. Like, a lot of the guys were either very young or very old, and it came across as, like,
either way, everyone was just happy to be working.
Yeah, they really enjoyed being there, and it was they don't shy away from the gore, the violence, as you might expect from, like, a 70-year-old filmmaker.
Mm.
it was very immodest. I mean,
yeah, it's definitely one of those films where you look at it and you look at who made it and it's like, oh yeah, it's the guy who made the Guns of Navarone. It'll probably be fairly restrained, and then you actually start watching it. No, there's blood and guts and, you know, naked guys running around. There's flapping penises and boobs, and it's it's a very, very questionable taste. Mm-hmm. The last bit set in a nurse's dormitory is very obviously modeled on the Richard Speck killings,
yes,
which were still fairly recent at the time. So there's an extra added level of bad taste going on there. It's,
well, yeah, I mean, that was the kind of bad taste that they were accused of when they made Death Wish 4, The Crackdown, because it was released around the same time that Bernard Goetz, the so-called Death Wish killer, was put on trial. And Bronson was very defensive about that. He was quick to say, no, we had nothing to do with that. I signed the paperwork to do this movie a year and a half before this happened. But it's funny, there's a little hiccup in the press where you see where Menahem Golan is asked point blank if there was an influence. He's like, of course there was an influence! Oh, and then, like, the next day, the Cannes folks was like, shut up!
Anything to sell tickets, right?
Yeah. But it's just funny because, like, there was that brief little hiccup where he was like, of course we were influenced by them. And then everyone got their story in shape, and that story was, no, not at all. And the thing of it was, Bronson may have signed on to do the picture beforehand, but there wasn't a finished script. And, you know, it's just a bit vague about whether or not what lit a fire under them was the Goetz case or not. I tend to believe it was, that it was an idea in their heads that they wanted to do. But, you know, this is the mentality we're talking about. We're talking about guys that, like, they would capitalize on this stuff. I mean, for example, J. Lee Thompson, he was, he would tell a biographer later that he regretted the types of pictures he made later in his life, or that by most people's standards, he was a sellout because of, you know, compared 10 to Midnight, for example, to Cape Fear and Guns of Navarone.
Right.
But he was like, by the standards of Hollywood, though, he was a success because he made money.
Yeah, his films were profitable and successful. And you know, at least from a creative standpoint, they're not completely dismissible.
The thing is, though, they didn't make enough money. I mean, Kinjite was basically released very shortly before Canon declared bankruptcy. So it was very much the end of an era when it went under.
Right.
And, like, they were at the time only releasing very few theatrically films. And it was telling that, like, Bronson was their moneymaker.
Right.
More so than, like, you know, Norris or some of the others, even though Norris had the number one film that
Missing
in Action is their biggest. But anyway, we're going all over the place, yeah. I'm sorry.
But yeah, so one thing I did kind of appreciate about 10 to Midnight, something that really kind of gets into both the very sort of locked-in binary focus of both this film and the 80s Bronson films in general, is just how hard the film sides with the Bronson character as a real man over the, you know, the liberal panty waists who want to coddle criminals. Yes. Like I said, I noticed at least three different lines where Bronson gets to rail against the legal system as, the way the law protects those maggots out there, you'd think they were an endangered species.
Yeah.
Or, I remember when legal meant lawful, now it means some kind of a loophole.
I think Bronson had this type of movie in mind when he said, I don't like the type of movies I make.
Mm.
And it was telling that when, in 1974, when the first Death Wish came out, he was talking about
retiring shortly after?
No, he was talking about working with Michael Winner, and he was saying that the first three Death Wish films that he did with him he was talking about his collaborations with Winner in general, like these types of pictures.
So, are we talking about when he did Death Wish 4, or are we talking about when he did the first Death Wish?
Collaborating with Winner, because he quit after Winner, that was his last Winner collaboration.
Death Wish 3.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But basically, he said, like, these pictures that I do with Michael Winner don't require a lot of acting of me. I'm basically a presence to be sold. I'm like a bar of soap to be sold. He compared himself to a product.
Yeah, and that's, because I haven't read Bronson's Loose again, but I did read Bronson's Loose. And there is that sort of, you know, when you look at his interviews, there's that sort of back and forth between his knowledge of his role in the cinema and his wish that he had been able to do something else.
Well, I mean, I'm not just drawing on Bronson's Loose Again. I'm drawing on a lot of articles that I read, because Bronson's Loose Again is a rather good, but not a comprehensive look at what was going on, right, with Bronson, because it's very respectful in most cases, and it kind of shies away from making judgments because they, you know, he clearly, clearly likes these films. Yeah.
I mean, it's not that kind of book. But the thing I was going to get to about the detail that I love about this, that really just kind of sets that Bronson versus the soft world, mm-hmm, sort of dichotomy that you get throughout all four of these J. Lee Thompson films, is the bit, it's just a throwaway bit where he's visiting his daughter at the nursing school she's working at, and they're in the cafeteria.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets quiche by accident because he thought it was pie.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, he's like, I hate quiche. And then he comes back with, like, a chicken leg and mashed potatoes because real men don't eat quiche.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I responded with that quote, though, about him not liking the types of movies that he did, because, like, I'll give you another more specific quote where he basically said, the movies I make are, you know, he's talking about Death Wish 2 and 3, and mm-hmm, he's basically saying that, like, people like this type of film, and the interviewer was made a point to point out that he speaks very slowly and deliberately, as if he's choosing his words very carefully.
Right.
And he's basically saying that, like, these movies serve a need. Mm-hmm. People want them. People, they speak to them, and that they talk about how, like, they wish they could do stuff like this. And in that sense, it's very careful, because on some level, I maintain that he did not identify as this macho type. I think that he saw it as an opportunity to exploit. I think he saw it as an opportunity to make himself a star, but I maintain that there were as many rewrites as there were on those films because he was not happy making money consistently off of movies like that. And we'll get into it a little later, but I just want to lay the groundwork for that now, yeah, because I think he was very discontent with his.
And image. You have to look at the fact that, you know, I mean, he tried to get Jill Ireland involved in his films as often as possible, because here he is, you know, action man, but off camera he's a quiet, private guy who really just likes spending time with his wife and his kid,
mm-hmm,
and doesn't need any friends or anybody like that.
Not very friendly on set.
He's like, I just want to go be with the people I love and live my life, and that's it, you know.
Yeah, so it's a job. It's a job for him.
So just let me do my thing.
We should move on to.
But anyway, yeah. So that's very much about 10 to Midnight.
Yeah.
Honestly, I mean, 10 to Midnight is there's not a whole lot to say about it, I guess.
Not really.
It's if you've heard the plot, you pretty much know the film. It's very slick and very well made, and it's certainly entertaining enough, but
it's gross.
There's definitely a hollowness to it.
Yeah.
And I guess it's the hollowness that does make the exploitable elements come off as potentially offensive.
Yes.
Which, like, I know Roger Ebert gave it a 0-star review.
Yeah, he also gave Death Wish 2 a 0-star review.
Death Wish 2 deserves it more than 10 to Midnight does.
Oh, yeah, for the rape scenes, yeah.
Yeah, Death Wish 2 is kind of a 10 to Midnight is a hollow film made by professionals who are just trying to make the best film they can. Death Wish 2 might actually be made by a guy who's getting off on the rape scenes.
Oh, Michael Winner, for sure, yeah.
Yeah. Michael Winner is a very interesting character, and we've talked about him before. We did a whole podcast about some of his films.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, he's I think I mentioned to you, it's interesting how he comes off in these books about how he's a consummate professional and a dude who can make a film on time and under budget every time.
Well, the reason why Thompson...
And he's also a complete scumbag.
Well, the reason why Bronson liked working with Thompson was for a couple reasons. He has fewer setups, so it was easier on Bronson, the working process. But it was also because Death Wish 3 with Winner, supposedly there was a falling out because Bronson thought it was gratuitously violent. And he even accused Winner of basically going behind his back to add more gore. He would basically, the story goes that when Bronson left the set, Winner was like, okay, now we have the extras, shoot more gore, yes, and violent, more squib scenes.
Yep, yep.
And Bronson found out, and he was pissed.
Yeah.
He's especially, I don't know why he singled this out, but he was especially, this is just a bit of trivia, he was especially upset about the scene where the punks are getting blown away after they harass him about his car. I don't know why he was upset about that particularly, but he felt like that was excessive. He called that excessive violence.
Yeah, didn't he threaten to walk off the set after that? Or
he did, but you know, he still did interviews. Yeah. He still did Death Wish 4 and 5, so...
But then again, you know, again, Winner wasn't doing Death Wish 4.
He wasn't invited. That was the thing.
Yes.
The story goes that basically Bronson was the one that was constantly, up until that point, recommending Winner. Mm. Winner was having... his career was in a bit of a tailspin, and
every time he did something that wasn't Death Wish, it bombed hard.
Yes.
Well, that's what happens when you make Wonton Tom the dog that saved Hollywood.
Amongst other non-hints. Yeah. But yeah, we should talk about men.
Another thing I think is interesting that I want to bring up, because I want to come back to it, is that doing these films chronologically, you can also kind of see in miniature just how much Bronson aged in a span of 6 years.
Yeah.
And you can see it happening progressively through the films. Because I believe he's, 61 during the making of 10 to Midnight?
10 to Midnight's 81?
83.
Oh, no, he'd be 62.
Okay.
Because he was born in 1921. Well,
it was released in 83. It might have been filmed in 82. I don't know.
No, so but, 61.
Yeah. But the point is, he was definitely starting to get up there. And, you know, rumor has it that he had work done on his face.
Winner was very quick to corroborate that rumor.
Yeah, yeah. But you know, one of the reasons that's been floating around is that he wanted to appear younger to do this film, because the character was supposed to be younger than he actually was.
At the same time, one of my favorite anecdotes in Bronson's Loose Again, the Paul Talbot book, is the line where supposedly on a press tour for Death Wish 4, Bronson sees a poster for him and he says, like, he tells the Canon press agent, it's like, you know, who's in charge of this stuff? I don't see any wrinkles here. People want to see my wrinkles.
You got rid of them all, dude. Left them back in Hard Times.
Yeah, no, like, he was like, it's like, people want to see, like, that's what they pay to see. They want to see old man Bronson kicking ass. And I found that funny.
But yeah, and so, in 10 to Midnight, he's still even though he's obviously coming on in years, he's still relatively spry. He has a lot of...
Except when he's running. Good God.
Yeah, well. Yeah, there's that whole bit at the end where the naked dude is running after his daughter and he's trying to keep up, and he apparently gets a hold of one of Jason's magic teleporters and manages to pop up right behind him at the end.
Yeah, yeah. There's this a bit like that in Death Wish 4 where, like, he's chasing down this guy who eventually guns down and the body flops onto the bumper cars.
Bumper car scene.
Oh, man, it's glorious because he climbs up this ladder and he's just shooting. He's just chasing him. It's something out of T.J. Hooker. It's like where they flattered Shatner by like making it seem as if like he was running real fast.
Yeah,
it looks like he's on a treadmill.
Yeah,
even though I'm sure they didn't do that with Bronson because he was too proud.
But so yeah, let's jump over to the next film, which is The Evil That Men Do, which is from, I believe, 1985.
I want to say 84.
Okay.
1984. It was released in 84.
Yeah.
When the system of justice doesn't work, Bronson does. When the courts can't do what they must, Bronson will. Bronson, fighting all the evil that men do.
Which relevant to what I was just saying there, still includes a relatively active Bronson. Bronson does a lot of running around in this film, especially near the end of the movie.
Yep.
But
he doesn't get the last laugh. I mean, this is a movie where...
That's the interesting thing about this, yeah. This is a Bronson film where he doesn't actually take the ultimate revenge. But
they rewrote that, though. I mean, that was, to be fair, that was another product of rewrites, but I don't know if it was instigated by him or not. No. I don't think it would have been, and because he was very conscious of the fact that, like, when people pay to go see a Bronson film, they want to see Bronson killing.
But at the same time, this is, in terms of the vengeance necessary to close out the film satisfactorily, what does transpire at the end of this film is certainly more satisfying than if Bronson had simply gunned down the villain.
Well, the plot of the movie is fairly simple. We should go into that. It's basically
It's a globetrotter.
It's a globetrotter where it's set in a South American country where
Argentina?
Guatemala.
It's because it's mostly set in Guatemala City.
And there's a bit where there's a disgraced doctor who is paid by these dictators and by political discontents to torture people and to perform experiments on people. And Bronson goes in there after a former friend of his is killed, right?
Yes. A friend of his who had tried to hide... He's playing a retired international assassin.
Yeah.
And his friend had tried to hire him to take care of certain elements within the government. His friend was a journalist who was being persecuted.
And you can see the similarities thematically in that sense between this and, like, a Commando or a Rambo. There's always basically the character who is retired and or is out of commission and brought in for one last mission in some third world country that they either have history with or that they're starting history with because it's personal this time. Right. There's, you know, some element that's bringing them back. And I just think it's really interesting because, like, of the sub-Rambo category of films, this one is plenty bloody, and it announces its intentions fairly early on.
You mean right in the opening scene where the doctor is torturing Bronson's friend to death?
Yes.
With electrodes, and it's basically like an outtake from a fucking Ilsa movie.
Yes, and blood is gushing down this guy's legs, on his chest, on his face.
Yeah, and you can see he's totally naked in some sort of weird sex harness thing.
Yeah.
And you can totally see his nutsack squeezing through his thighs.
Thompson, apparently, for this movie, was very gung-ho about the blood. Or at least if you're to believe Talbot's account, the interviews that Talbot got for the book. There are multiple occasions where Thompson would basically would insist on more gore. He did not shy away. This is a 70-something-year-old filmmaker, and he was like, "More gore, guys! Like there's a shootout later in the movie.
We need some blood."
Apparently, he was on set with like a little bucket of paint and he just sprinkle it around.
That's
and he
awesome. Says,
more blood.
Sorry, folks. I'm getting over a bit of a cold, so
you're fine.
I'm trying not to cough, but.
But yeah, he, you know, this is the mentality of these guys. Like they, you know, this was they were like Bronson. They were professional in the sense that they knew what they were was expected of them implicitly.
Yeah, they knew what was selling in the marketplace. So they're like, let's do it.
Yeah, the problem was that I find it fascinating. Between this and I think Messenger of Death, these are some of the most heavily rewritten canon films of the period. And
that's the thing. The Evil That Men Do is the one film we're talking about that isn't canon.
Oh, okay, right. No, it's
I forget the production company.
We'll have to look it up. But
it's not a canon film, and I actually think it has a little something that the canon films don't. I think it's a little looser. I think it's a little freer. It's not so hidebound to certain genre structures. I actually found myself kind of enjoying this movie quite a lot. I mean,
I found it boring.
It's not a great film, but it's I kind of looked at it as the sort of film that if I had been 15 and I'd been home from school for whatever reason and I happened to turn on like Channel 13 or whatever local station was on and I walked into this like 20 minutes in, I would have watched the whole thing and I would have had a really good time.
ITC, which was they had a deal with TriStar. I remember
okay.
now.
Okay.
So yeah, they I think they Canon slept on this movie, which is why they didn't get to do it. It was that rare instance where they snoozed and lost
right
on out on the opportunity.
But I do think the you know the sort of international man of mystery suits Bronson pretty well. He seems very comfortable in the role, mm-hmm. and I think that there are a number of scenes in this movie where it's just like, yeah, okay. Like the bit where, you know, Bronson's trying to lure one of the doctor's bodyguards home with promises of sex.
Uh-huh.
But first he has to defeat some giant Guatemalan who's taken a shine to his faux wife.
Yeah, at the bar, yeah.
And, yeah, so he just beats the guy up by twisting his dick off.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
what a time.
I did also find it interesting that, this film was apparently cobbled together out of bits from other movies that J. Lee Thompson really, really likes,
mm-hmm.
and decided to stick little homages to in the middle of his movies. Like you've got the opening bit, which is very Ilsa. You've got the bit at the cockfight, which the way it's staged is totally a Strangers on a Train homage.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the bit in the cafe near the end in the town of Magdalena.
My daughter, dear.
Which is absolutely just, you know, putting Bronson back in a Western.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got the ending where they stage it in a mine and have all the miners who turn out to be victims of the doctor. And they come out and just, like, siege his limo. It is totally a fucking Freaks homage.
Yeah.
Absolutely is.
I mean, it's I wouldn't be surprised, honestly.
It just struck me that everyone involved in this was probably having a better time than in the other films. That we're talking about today. And I think it kind of translates into the finished product, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, man. Like, I watched this movie, and I don't even think it's, like, primo 80s Bronson. And I have a fascination with this period. I don't know if I would out and out say that I like any of them. I especially, the movie that I know you're least hot on, Messenger of Death, is one that I find endearingly stagnant.
That's a good word for it.
It's interesting. It's interesting. I don't think it's a good film. I own it on Blu-ray, though, which shows you my commitment to Sparkle Motion, I think. I like it, in that sense, on the sliding scale of likes, but are we going into it? I mean, is that the next one?
Yeah, Messenger of Death. I mean, if you've got nothing else to say about The Evil That Men Do.
The Evil That Men Do is boring.
So, yeah, you've got nothing to say about it, huh?
Nah, I mean, it was a bloody movie. It was a movie that, like, I would lump in with the period of Bronson pictures that he was arguably trying to get away from, and this is 84, so 84... His wife is still struggling with breast cancer.
Yep. She passed away in, what, 87, I think?
1990.
Oh, wow.
She was struggling right until the end, so... but we'll get into that. Yeah. Don't ruin my narrative!
I'm sorry!
Very good.
So on to Messenger of Death, which was... Was that post-Death Wish 4 or pre-Death Wish 4?
Oh, that was post.
Yeah, post-Death Wish 4.
Charles Bronson, Messenger of Death.
What happened with Messenger of Death is there were some heavy rewrites. It was originally based on a novel called The Avenging Angel,
mm-hmm.
and there were some pretty significant rewrites that were happening throughout the shoot, and... It was rewritten by a guy named Paul Jericho, also in his 70s. Jericho was basically a guy that was blackballed in the 50s after refusing to testify at HUAC, and he fled to Europe to continue working.
Mm-hmm.
Jericho was another one of these guys that was just happy to be working, and
yeah.
He constantly rewrote that picture. To the point where he was providing new pages every day during the shoot. And Messenger of Death was, I think, one of the best indicators that you can find of Bronson struggling with his image. Because, you know, you had the PG-13 assassination a little before that,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
which was a different type of picture,
yep.
A lot less sleazy.
Mm-hmm.
You had Murphy's Law, which was PG, which was R, but I think that was mostly for language.
Mm.
I know Odie Henderson, who's is a fan of Murphy's Law, by the way.
Yes.
Messenger of Death, I think, is interesting because it's an R-rated movie that refused to give people the satisfaction that they associated, or at least that Bronson associated with Bronson's pictures.
It's mainly R-rated for that opening sequence.
Well, I'll get into
that. And that is and incidentally, that opening sequence is A, beautifully directed, and B, the best part of the film.
It's all downhill from there. But basically, this is a movie that's about Bronson is a reporter who investigates a massacre of his family, a Mormon family, I believe.
Yes, and it's as the film takes myriad pains to point out, the families involved are part of a radical Mormon sect that had broken off from the regular Mormons. There's a line which says, "When my father broke with the Salt Lake theocracy," like the filmmakers are begging, "Please, please, Mormon Church, don't sue us."
Yeah, I mean there's a conspiracy, political conspiracy here that is as close to Chinatown as you're going to find in Bronson pictures.
I wrote it's that the Hatfield McCoy stuff is being stoked by a water company trying to buy land. So basically, it's a redneck Chinatown.
It is a redneck Chinatown, and Bronson has to investigate. But ultimately, I'll just give you I'll spoil the ending for you. He does not kill anybody. He does not get retribution in that sense. In fact, the guy responsible for this conspiracy,
who looks like Mike Huckabee, by the way,
he does. That's a good point. He kills himself when confronted by Bronson.
And
people didn't like that, though. Bronson fans, supposedly, according to Thompson, they got angry letters. And you won't find that in Bronson's Loose Again, because it disrupts the narrative that he has of this just being a wacky, kooky fun time with questionable people. but yeah, this...
And it is an outlier in terms of the films that Bronson was making at the time. In fact, its entire thrust seems to be anti-vengeance.
Yes.
And, you know, the setting it among a religious community certainly stokes that, but it's you know, he's on multiple occasions, like, deliberately warned against seeking any sort of vengeance that's not his to take.
Well, one of the significant rewrites of this movie was foregrounding, for starters, the massacre, so that instead of being in the middle of the picture, it was at the start. And also, it was much more graphic in the pre-Jericho draft.
Okay.
The first draft of this picture was apparently really, really specific about what you're seeing.
Mm.
Apparently, there were bullets put in everyone's heads, including children, women. There was, like, you know, there were graphic details about what the corpses were doing, what they were doing when they were gunned down, and, like... I mean, let me see if I can find the right passage here on the fly, but I think that it's notable that, like, this movie was significantly watered down, and I love the description of it, which is why I'm taking the moment to find it. But go ahead.
And just in terms of the idea of watering it down, I think it is significant that in this that Bronson's not playing any sort of authority figure or anybody with any experience in killing. He's playing a reporter.
Yes.
And what I think is one of the things about this movie is, at this late stage in his career, it keeps Bronson from having to really perform any major action sequences, aside from one little fist fight at the end of the film, which nevertheless is covered very carefully to prevent any sort of contact from actually taking place, because It just the couple years since The Evil That Men Do, Bronson is apparently slowing down quite a lot. But the profession keeps him from having to do too much violent action. But it's also interesting in that at this late stage in his career, it doesn't seem like Bronson knows how to play someone anymore who isn't a man of action.
I don't think he was comfortable with it. I think that would be the better way to put it. I found the passage, by the way. It was great. It says, in the description of the original scene of the massacre, "On the parlor floor, three dead women can be seen, lying in grotesque positions, mouths open in horror, bullet wounds in each heart and forehead. Flies surround them, buzzing gruesomely. There are five dead children, piled up in the corner, all clinging to each other. Three girls from 11 to 14, two boys from 8 to 10, all have been brutally shot in the head and the heart, their eyes wide open, blood covering their dead faces. A dog, just a big yellow-haired mutt with a bullet hole in his head, lying in a corner. A little baby, 2 months old, is in the crib, shot through the head. The playpen has a one-year-old toddler sprawled on his back, shot through heart and head. The small bed holds the corpse of a young girl, perhaps 4 years old, shot through heart and head, flies crawling all around her bloody mouth.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and say that the final product would not have been included, not have been improved by including any of that.
No, it wouldn't. But it's interesting because I think that the Bronson's sort of tacit agreement to sign on to these bloody movies was wearing thin. I mean, Death Wish 4 is a primo example. I mean, that's a movie that was rewritten significantly.
Oh, and Death Wish 4, reading Bronson's Loose, it kind of confirmed what I always suspected about Death Wish 4, in that there was a really interesting movie you could have made out of that.
That was 1987, by the way.
It bears out in the opening dream sequence.
The opening dream sequence, which was rewritten, it was one of the few main holdovers from the original script that...
The idea of essentially a PTSD Paul Kersey.
Yes. And they wanted to have his wife, Jill Ireland's character, to return from her role after Death Wish 2, but she did not want to because she had just published her memoir in 87, Life Wish, and she was very uncomfortable with the idea of playing a character who dies.
Yeah, because the idea was to kill her character off.
Yes.
Fun fact, Jill Ireland's character in Death Wish 2 is the only love interest for Paul Kersey who does not die.
Yeah, she in Death Wish 4, the character who does wind up dying has a very violent death. She gets shot in the back, and her back basically is a squib war zone.
Yeah.
It is pretty dramatic, and again, it was the type of movie that Bronson, in interviews, wanted to try to get away from. He would say things like, try to rack my brains for this quote, but he basically was saying that, like, I don't want to do movies, I want to be identified with movies with violence in them anymore, which is striking because, like, Kinjite is not a violent picture.
But it's a gross picture.
It's a very gross picture. So,
but, what I wanted to say about Messenger of Death is, it's definitely the sort of film that feels like it was being rewritten constantly.
Yeah.
And I realized that when, you know, the third act starts when Bronson finds out about the conspiracy and starts going to, you know, to dig up what's actually going on. And Trish Van Devere, the female lead, who's playing the owner of the small town newspaper where all the warring Mormons live, just fucking vanishes from the film.
Yeah.
Because I guess they couldn't figure out a way to keep her in the movie. So it's just like, oh yeah, this character we've been following around, yeah, we're not gonna bother with her anymore. She doesn't get an exit scene or anything. It's just like the film forgets she exists.
Yeah, I guess I find it interesting because it is such a tortured film. I mean, it feels like it signifies a jumping off point for... It feels like a transitional film in the sense that it could have led to something interesting and it wound up just leading to the wrong kind of interesting. I mean... Kinjite Forbidden Subjects is...
Yeah, I guess the idea, the failure of the relatively unique Messenger of Death led everyone involved to double down on all the things that were in the other films that people seemed to like.
Thompson apparently would say that Messenger of Death got a lot of hate mail because people saw, according to him, you know, they would see posters of Bronson with a gun in hand.
That's from one scene in the movie where Bronson shoots at an empty coffin.
Yeah.
It's the only time he wields a gun in that movie, and it's not his gun!
Yep. they were mad, and he cited the ending, because understandably the ending of that picture is not cathartic in the way that people wanted from Bronson.
From Bronson picture. Films, yeah.
So, I find it to be an interesting failure. I mean, most of these movies are just borderline failures for me, but I find this one, or mostly just because they're repugnant fucking films, but I find them interesting in that, like, they're showing you the ugly side of when what would happen if you had an action star who was being produced A, at the end of his most profitable period of his career, and B, when the people that are guiding him are sleaze merchants.
Yeah. Like, and, you know, speaking of repugnant, Kinjite!
Oh. It was Duke who put you out on the street. He made you turn tricks.
Duke was good to me.
Charles Bronson.
Everybody, on the floor, now!
Kinjite, forbidden subjects.
Yeah,
Kinjite
is the last collaboration between J. Lee Thompson and Charles Bronson.
Because he died.
Yeah, it is also J. Lee Thompson's last film, which is a hell of a film to go out on.
Something, all right.
And it is about a cop who, in investigating, I don't know if Bronson's supposed to be specifically a vice cop, or if he's just a cop who happens to have taken up a grudge against this particular pimp who deals in young girls, mostly underage girls.
Duke!
Yes, yes. He ends up getting involved with the Asian community, the Japanese community.
Because he's a racist.
Because he is a racist.
They try to work that in there. That wasn't originally in there.
And I think I quipped on Twitter at the time that this is basically a film made by Walt Kowalski, Clint Eastwood's character from Gran Torino.
Right.
And the arc of this film can be legitimately summed up as a man learns to hate yellow people less so that he can better hate brown people.
Yeah.
And that's just scratching the surface of this incredibly fucked up film.
Oh, I'm sure Bronson would argue, though, that, like, the fact that he was brown is coincidental. What he really hates is the child prostitution stuff. And, because this movie is basically about the fact that he goes after this guy, Duke the Pimp, is because he is prostituting children. And, he sees red, Bronson's character sees red anytime someone threatens the sanctity of
young girls,
especially his daughter.
It makes him angry enough to shove a vibrator up somebody's ass.
Oh, yeah.
So if you ever wanted to see Charles Bronson handle a dildo...
That was a rewrite, by the way.
Kinjite is your movie.
That was not in the original script. But trivia, I know. Fun fact. But yeah, so this movie is right at the end of not just the canon films, but like the Bronson. He took a break right after making Kinjite because his wife was had another very ill with breast cancer, and he basically took a 2-year hiatus after filming to be with her. And right from 87 through 1990, late 87. And I think that it's too much of a coincidence. I think he liked working. That's the thing. The constant refrain you'll hear from people is he liked working. So I think that it's telling that, like, the combination of personal trauma and, I mean, this is armchair psychologizing, I know, but I think that it was the breaking point for him. And I think it's funny, in an interview that I read, J. Lee Thompson is being tellingly interviewed for Kinjite, not Bronson. And Thompson says that, you know, Bronson's a really good actor. He deserves to be in better pictures. And I don't think he meant it the way it came out,
but the interviewer
ran with it.
Yeah, that's like, oh, yeah, so he doesn't deserve to be in the film you made.
Yep.
Oh,
and, I mean, the interviewer was quick to point that out. It's like, even though Thompson is the one making the picture.
Yeah. And Kinjite is just one of those, I don't know, man. It's a film that every time you think it's about to do something terrible, it doubles down on it and does something more terrible.
Oh, yeah, it gets off on that heinous groper scene where... There's a Japanese businessman who becomes the the focus of Bronson's ire. And this Japanese guy is drunk on a train, and he sees this white woman getting molested on the train.
No, she's not white. She's Japanese.
Oh, she's Japanese.
It's back in Japan, that.
Back in Japan. Thank you. But he sees this character getting molested, and he starts to get ideas. And later, he will track him out.
He comes in, like, the next scene after that, he's in a club with a compatriot. And he's like, she was having an orgasm!
Yeah, he's fascinated, clearly. And so was the filmmaker.
Yeah.
So, because, like, the scene goes on. And you just, they relish the orgasmic pleasure this woman is getting while she is being molested on the fucking train. And the character tries that shit with Bronson's daughter, which leads to a bout of a fit that Bronson has where he pulls over in his squad car and he's like, look at all these Japanese people.
Oh, they
own the place.
The amazing old man rant.
Yep.
That ends with him going,
and you're fucking up fucking me.
Yeah.
But even just in terms of the how that works out, it's like it kind of points up the not even latent, just the blatant racism of all this. Because what happens in Japan is the woman may or may not be getting off on her, may just be too coy to intimidated to say anything about it, but just stands there and takes it. And then you come to America, where things are right, and the instant that this guy touches someone, she screams, he gets kicked off a bus, and that leads to a street fight, and then he gets mugged.
Yeah.
Like, one minor incident leads to three crimes in one night.
I find Kinjite interesting for the same reason I like Messenger of Death, but it's infinitely sleazier.
Oh, and it also leads to the line, some Oriental guy touched my holy of holies.
Yeah.
Because Bronson's daughter is a very pure and upstanding young woman.
Yes. Kinjite is as gross as you heard, but it's got the kind of personality of an actor who is, again, trying to figure out what the next step is.
I grudgingly respect it because, goddamn, you got to give it credit. It's pure.
It
knows what it is, and it's going for the gusto. Mm-hmm. It's nasty as hell, but it knows it is, and it's gonna. Every time you think it's touched bottom, it's gonna grab a shovel.
Well said.
It literally, like, just when you think it can't get any worse, it literally ends on Bronson's telling Duke, yeah, I didn't kill you because I thought it would be more appropriate for you to be raped to death in prison.
Oh, no, there's that scene where he brings Duke to jail.
Yeah.
And some of the inmates in there, including young Danny Trejo.
Yes.
He gets put in a cell, and he says,
that's justice.
Yeah, that's literally the last line of the film and the last line of J. Lee Thompson and Bronson's collaboration career. That's justice.
Yeah, that he's about to get raped.
Repeatedly.
Yeah.
Over God knows how many years.
Yeah.
Until he dies.
Yeah, that's justice.
From being raped too much. It's really an interesting capper to the whole idea of the vigilante persona that Bronson has cultivated, and mm-hmm. it's the world's getting increasingly rough, and I guess the idea is you have to get rougher with it.
You have to fight fire with fire.
But, you know, you pass a certain point, and you're letting people be raped to death.
By Danny Trejo's
friends. While Danny Trejo watches and films it, probably.
Trejo, incidentally, was in Death Wish 4 also.
I thought it was Death Wish 3 he was in.
I think it's 4. But
I thought that was, God, was that the film where he actually got his big break? Because he was supposed to be, like, an advisor. And, you know, like, some guy was being a shithead. And Trejo, like, stepped in and put him in his place. And the director was like, you're amazing! Let me put you in the movie!
I believe it was 4, but let me just...
Okay, it could be Death Wish 4. You're right.
Suck it.
No, I don't want to suck it.
Suck it!
That's justice.
Yeah, anyway, so next segment that we have for the podcast is the Netflix Grab Bag, which is a monthly feature that we do where, you know, when you have your Netflix accounts, you probably have items in there that have been festering for years, months, who knows how long. And you just need a kick in the pants to watch them. So we do something where it's a bad idea, where we basically, we randomly choose, we alternate between my queue and Steve's queue, DVD and Instant, where we flip a coin to decide that. And then we randomly choose four films that neither of us have seen.
And then you guys vote on them.
And we have you vote. So we got this this month's title from Steve's queue, and you voted.
My DVD queue.
It was a tight vote, but you voted for Zombie 3. Italian zombie picture, nominally directed by Lucio Fulci.
It was originally intended to be directed by Fulci, and he directed part of it and then fell ill.
Yes. And then Claudio Fragoso and Bruno Mattei co-directed it. Ghost-directed it, I should say. And
Ghost-directed!
Ghost-directed! Yeah. And it is...
It is exactly the kind of fiasco you'd expect from that tortured history.
Yes.
And yet, it's also everything you would expect from a movie called Zombie 3. You know, I love the title, because Zombie 3 is obviously a sequel to Zombie 2, which was the Italian title for Fulci's Zombie. But releasing it in America as Zombie 3 means that you literally just jump from Zombie to Zombie 3, and there is no Zombie 2.
There is no Zombie 2. I enjoyed
William Zombie Buffet's 3. There is no Zombie 2.
I like, yeah, there is no
Zombie 2. Real in nerd joke there.
Fuck off. You make me mad. But yeah, so Zombie 3 I enjoy despite its shittiness, glaring shittiness, because it feels like a movie from the guy that did Hell of the Living Dead, which is another Mattei zombie film. It's full of animal stock footage, thank you. And it is ridiculous in the excessive gore. It gives you what you want in that sense. It gets grossly incompetent in setting up these scenes of gore, but it is frequently a fun time because you have to sort of get on the level where you're watching a picture like this.
Well, it's,
and you have to accept it for what it's doing.
What's our watchword, you know? You judge every film according to its intentions.
I thought our watchword was fuck you, Steve Carlson.
Well, that too. But
fuck you! Oh. Okay, sorry.
But, yeah, no, if you're looking for high art, you're not going to go watch Zombie 3. If you're looking for a movie called Zombie 3, you should know what you're getting yourself into. And this delivers everything you would expect.
Yeah. And except, there was not a lot of sex in this one. Or nudity.
But then again, there's not a lot of sex in either Fulci Zombie or Dawn
of the Dead. No, but there's a fair amount of nudity in, for example, Hell of Living Dead.
But I just mean in terms of the major films.
You're treating this like a franchise.
I'm just saying.
There are no rules to this franchise, my friend.
Fuck your franchise.
That's my point. That's my... We agree!
Fuck your point!
No!
Yes!
I can't, it's theoretical! You can't fuck an idea, Steve Carlson!
Says who?
That's the title for this.
You can't fuck an idea?
You can't fuck an idea.
That's a pretty good title, actually.
No, okay. We have to add Steve Carlson. Anyway, Zombie 3...
Marvin K. Mooney, will you please fuck off?
Zombie 3 is like... fucking... barrel scraping bullshit, and it is it's fun.
It is. It's a lot of fun. It's a garbage film. I mean, it's yet another post Fulci Italian zombie film where it's the military accidentally creating zombies, like Hell of the Living Dead, I think, is one of them. Night of the Zombies. There's a couple others. Does Burial Ground fall into that too, or am I?
I forget the reasons for that in Burial Ground.
Yeah, I don't remember that either. But you know, whatever.
I don't think that counts.
It's the thinnest sliver of an idea to hang zombies on. You know, whatever. It's an excuse to film 90 uninterrupted minutes of people in fucking oatmeal makeup eating other people.
It often feels in that sense like the Italian answer to the trauma picture, because there's pulsing green blood.
And not just because the zombies look like the original version of the Toxic Avenger.
Oh, I mean, it just feels like montage after montage, scene after scene of giving the viewer what they want, just aggressive pandering.
Every time you think that, oh, I've seen it all, it's like, nope, we're gonna have zombies jump out of the ceiling and be ninja zombies, or we're gonna throw a floating zombie head out of a refrigerator, or like it's fucking Mystics and Valley up in here.
Or the bit where the zombie launches at this woman and she ducks and he falls out the window, or the other one
whacks himself in the dick on the way down.
Or the bit where this woman is climbing upstairs and she gets punked by this zombie who pushes her off.
Yes!
He pushes her off
into the river.
Into the river, and you just think like, oh, she's just fine, it's just water. And the guy pulls her out, and oh my god, her legs are missing and she's a zombie now!
Yes! Or the woman who walks into an otherwise abandoned building and finds a pregnant woman on an operating table.
Yeah.
And then the zombie baby rips its way out of her belly and grabs her in the face after another zombie has walked up behind her and ripped her face off.
In the face. She grabs someone else in the face. Get it right.
Okay.
Get it right.
The point is, there is a zombie baby in this.
There is
a zombie baby.
I've seen at least one more movie with a zombie baby.
Burial Ground.
Oh, and of course the Zack Snyder Dawn of the Dead.
Zack Snyder Dawn of the Dead, yes.
Yeah.
And, well, of course, Brain Dead.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's
the most famous of all zombie babies.
Mm-hmm. And in the video game Zombies Ate My Neighbors.
There's zombie babies in that?
I think there's gotta be. I think one of the bosses is a baby. That's a cat, bud. That is not a baby.
I don't do good babies.
That's what you were doing. You were just meowing.
But yeah, so I don't really know what else you can say about Zombie 3. I know we haven't talked much about it, but it's literally just a zombie delivery system.
Yeah.
And it's relentless in doing so, but it's fun and stupid and pointless, and
I'd recommend it.
I would absolutely recommend it. It's like eating McDonald's. It's not haute cuisine, but you know what you're getting, and fuck it, you like it.
Yeah, it's not bad.
It's
bad, but it's not.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the fact that, you know, Claudio Fragasso and Bruno Mattei are both involved in making it, it could have been a lot worse.
Yeah, it could have just been bad and not fun.
Yeah, it's bad in a way where it's like, we have to get zombies on screen at every single point, otherwise the audience will get bored.
Yeah, admittedly, I did get a little bored otherwise.
Well, you know, when something is so single-minded, it can be easy to get bored, but this film kind of staved it off by having zombies come out of every single fucking corner they could, so.
Agreed.
In every single possible way, including a flying head in a refrigerator.
Aw, yeah.
And what I do want to say a little something about the disc we watched this on, which is an old Shriek Show Media Blasters disc. Apparently the print that they used was edited and they could only get copies of the unedited version on a tape master. So you can always tell when something ridiculously gory is about to happen, because it'll switch to VHS resolution and then like the lighting will go down and then someone will get a fucking spike in the throat or something.
Yeah.
Or someone will get their face torn off.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, no, I mean, if you like zombie movies, you should probably check out Zombie 3. We don't have much to say about it, because it's just zombies. Literally, it's just zombies, but it's fun, and there's a Winnebago, and there's army guys, and helicopter.
This is a woman who has a great difficulty getting her top off.
Yes.
She's just like, she's giggling a lot, and she's sticking her torso out the window.
I don't know how buttons work!
Yeah, and the whole time, when the car stops, after her car is invaded by killer zombie birds, I was just like, if I were these guys, my first thought wouldn't be, hey, let's help your friend. By the logic of this movie, his next line should be, can I help you with that third button?
An interesting fun fact I pointed out to Simon before we started podcasting, the lead in this film, the lead army guy, is played by Darren Serafian, who is a Hollywood director now, best known for doing Van Damme's Death Warrant and being a producer on House, apparently. He's also the child of Richard Serafian, director of the famous cult film Vanishing Point. And there is a black DJ in this movie who reminded me a lot of Cleavon Little's DJ in Vanishing Point, except that Cleavon Little never becomes a zombie. So there is that. And also, Darren Serafian only acted in 5 films, according to the IMDb, and was only credited for 3 of them, one of which was Zombie 3. And one of the others was 10 to Midnight. He has a small role in 10 to Midnight, so...
You're not going to mention Plankton?
Somehow, he's uncredited for that.
You know what? Go fuck it. What about entries? Okay, sorry.
That's right. Go fuck yourself.
What about Gunman?
He directed that, too.
I know. It's got Christopher Lambert, Patrick Stewart, Mario Van Peebles, and Dennis Leary, and...
And it's a gigantic piece of shit. I've seen it. It's terrible.
I think people like it.
I don't care. I've seen it. It sucks.
I don't care about you. Anyway, so the
leaving is that you?
What? Yeah. Fuck off. That was a low blow. Anyway, so next month's podcast, we're asking you to vote for 4 titles that were taken from my Netflix instant queue.
Yep.
The first title is a film called House on Telegraph Hill, which is directed by Robert Wise, starring Richard Widmark, which is about...
That was Richard Basehart.
Richard Basehart, fuck off. Damn you, being right and shit. House on Telegraph Hill is... let me get you the synopsis on that fucking thing.
It's about a house, and it's on Telegraph Hill.
That's my favorite Who's Guru song.
I was just thinking that, too.
He's the girl who lives on Helen Hill. Concentration camp survivor Victoria Kowalska finds herself involved in murder, greed, and murder. Wait, no.
Mystery, greed, and murder?
Mystery, greed, and murder. I think murder, and murder is better. And she assumes the identity of a dead friend in order to gain passage to America. Anyway, so there's that, which looks good.
Looks pretty good.
The Nightmare, the Rodney Asher documentary about sleep paralysis, which neither of us have seen.
The Pearl Button.
The Pearl Button, the Patricio Guzman film, the Chilean film documentary filmmaker who did, what's that one called?
Nostalgia for the Light.
Oh, man, that movie's good.
I guarantee you Jaime Grijalva is going to vote for that.
Yeah, thanks, Jaime. This other one, and the last one is The Tribe, that one about that group of frequently naked...
Deaf kids behaving badly.
Yeah, they're bad. All I know about this movie is that it played at Cannes, the poster, or the art that is frequently passed around for it is a bunch of naked kids. Here it is. Here's the one. I'm showing Steve the
naked seen it.
Kids. You've seen the naked kids?
I've seen the naked kids. Apparently,
they're signing at each other, look.
Yes.
In the buff.
Apparently, it's a film you either really like or you fucking loathe. So
it's directed by a filmmaker who I'm going to make Steve pronounce this just because I want to torture him.
Miroslav Slaboshpitsky?
Yeah, that actually looks right.
Never underestimate me!
Yeah. Never overestimate you. Boom!
Oh.
Anyway, so next month's podcast, we're thinking we're going to make the theme about... I'll let Steve explain.
We were thinking about because we wanted to do something to kind of, because we didn't really do anything on the last podcast to be like, we're back, other than to say we're back. But I was thinking about it because our first podcast was about Frank Zappa and the films he has been involved in and directed or co-directed or whatever. So I wanted to loop it back around and do a series, a podcast about other films directed by musicians. And we don't mean, like, you know, the films that Neil Young has done either. You know, we're not talking quite that good because that's not what we do around here. So
we're talking about the Bad Idea Podcast. Yes. Which, incidentally, if you're listening to this podcast by accident and you've reached this watermark, you probably know that there's another podcast that has our name. And they took our name and they're keeping it despite the fact that they bumped into our presence on Twitter. These fucking people
really?
Are ridiculous. Yeah! At one point, someone was just like, "Hey guys, this is the Bad Idea Podcast!" And they tagged us, and we were just like, "Wrong podcast, bros."
Yeah.
And they were like, "Oh, oops." So they know that there's another podcast with that name, and they're sticking to it anyway because they're fucking assholes. And, you know, I'm sure they're probably lovely people, but this is a dick move. I'm sorry, guys. Find your own...
Podcast beef!
Fucking find your own title. I mean, come on. I mean, it's not like we came up with an amazing title, but it suits... It's the suitable umbrella for what we do, whereas your fucking podcast is about I don't care what, and it's probably should be about something called something else. Like the dumbasses. How about that?
What if they're literally doing the same thing we do?
Then they should get their... That's all the more reason to change their shit up. We fill a need.
What if it's just a couple Russians who've stolen our podcast and are translating it into Russian?
I'd be okay with that.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway.
Das Bad Idea Podcast.
Yes. Anyway, we're about to put up the Netflix grab bag. We just wanted to say thank you so much for listening. And until next month.
Bye!
Bye.
Go ahead. Take me in. You can't punish me.